sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Richard Agler, a remarkable story about transforming the personal loss of his daughter in meaningful and sacred ways. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last weekend, I had the pleasure of exchanging pulpits with my good friend, the Reverend Canon John Kitagawa of St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church, a historic congregation here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. There's a fascinating thing that happens when you preach a sermon in somebody else's congregation. First of all, the congregation stays awake. Second of all, they listen and really appreciate your words, since they don't have to listen to you every week. The theme of my talk was belief in a time of doubt, and the passage that the Episcopalians included in their readings last Sunday morning was taken from the Book of Kings in the Bible, the story of the prophet Elijah on the Carmel. In that dramatic tale, Elijah, through the direct intervention of God, triumphs over the many prophets of the false god Baal and restores the people of Israel to faith. At the conclusion of the episode, the whole people of Israel loudly proclaims, Adonai Hu Hai Elohim, the Lord is God, the Lord is God, enthusiastically. It's a passage we Jews still chant and say at the conclusion of Yom Kippur Ne'ilah services, at the end of the Day of Atonement, the holiest day of the year. And while today we live in an atmosphere of religious cooperation between Christians and Jews here in America, our Israelite ancestors lived in a situation of true religious competition, not cooperation. There was nothing inevitable about the triumph of monotheism or even its survival. It was a tenuous and chancy process that ultimately led to the notion that the belief in one non-idolatrous God was supreme. And of course, without the success of that religious enterprise, Judaism would not exist today. Neither would Christianity or Islam, leaving no one to proclaim Adonai Hu Hai Elohim, the Lord is God. In those days, more than 3 millennia ago, this process was perceived as a life and death struggle for religious survival, ultimately, but just barely won by those who chose to believe in one God. That did not mean that somehow we ended up with a unified people that faced no more religious competitors. Far from it. From the messages in our tradition, it's clear that each generation was challenged by new ideas and new competitors for the hearts and minds of our people. So our faith was challenged in every single generation. But that turns out not to have been a bad thing. In fact, what helped Judaism become a vibrant, evolutionary, dynamic religious tradition that has survived for nearly 4,000 years was the very diversity of the religious and ideological environments in which we Jews lived. It was the need to address the challenge posed by new ideas and different belief systems that compelled us to grow and change, to deepen our faith and our belief. Without the threat posed by religious and philosophical challengers, it's likely that the Judaism of Abraham and Moses would have disappeared long ago. The continuing need to address the changing world and its developing ideas and beliefs forced us to grow and change as well, to answer and sometimes incorporate new ways of thinking and acting into our continuously evolving tradition. You can make that same case, I believe, for Christianity and Islam as well. Without a continuing engagement with the world, without facing the challenges of new religious and philosophical ideas being argued and discussed in every single era, religions become reactionary and calcify. And in a fairly short period of time after that, they fade out of relevance and even disappear. That's why interfaith work and cooperation is so extraordinarily healthy for everyone involved and so essential for us. Because to be healthy and hearty, our ideas cannot exist in a vacuum. Our beliefs must face and overcome the challenges of each new generation. So what is our Mount Carmel today? What is it that truly challenges us as religious members of society? Today, we members of the mainstream religious denominations, Jews and Christians alike, are engaged in a philosophical and theological struggle that may also prove to be one for survival. Today, it is not the challenge of polytheism that threatens us, nor is it the danger that has been identified so often as radical Islam that threatens our belief and our society. Of course, there's a danger posed by radicalized Muslims, and this is dramatized by the terrorism that strikes our societies, but we should also know that this is not the first wave of radical Islamic activism to burst forth. There have been several such trends throughout the 1400-year history of Islam. And after this wave fades, and it will, we can readily predict that there will be another one sometime in the future. The challenge posed by radical Islam is not actually existential, nor is it an intellectual problem for the vast majority of us. Troubling as it is, it's not our principal problem today. In 2013 America, the competitive aspect of religious life is not really between different religious traditions or even within denominations. It's the challenge posed by the increasing secularization of the educated members of society. It's the questioning that so many of the best and brightest of our world do of the need for thoughtful, principled religiosity at all. How many of your children and grandchildren are questioning the very need for belief in God? How many are unwilling or unlikely to attend worship services on any regular basis now because they find no compelling reason to seek God through prayer and holy convocation? There is today a rising popularity of atheism, which I would define as the religious belief that God does not exist. I know a little bit about atheism and the challenge it poses, since I have a 16-year-old son, Boaz, who has been reading the atheist authors Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris, and is also the captain of debate at his high school. I must brag a little. For the second year in a row, that debate team at Catalina Foothills High School has won the Arizona State Championship, and my son has been a big part of that. The flip side is that he spends most of his recreational time either arguing or preparing to argue. And now he has become a big fan of atheist writing, and his father is a rabbi. This confluence of extraordinary elements provides a rare and remarkable opportunity for me to spend every waking moment at home engaged in argument with a highly verbal, highly motivated, and extremely articulate teenager. Thank you, God, for this special challenge administered daily, even hourly. Well, in any case, the case for atheism hasn't really changed much over the years. It's based in the idea that our universe was created at random, that scientific explanations provide the answers, or eventually will provide all the answers to all of our questions. I believe, as I always have, that science can provide the answers to many of our what and how questions without ever providing answers to our why questions. I personally find contemporary physics and cosmology to be fascinating and see many parallels to Jewish mystical teaching on the same subject. And while it's extremely important to remain engaged in this discussion and debate, not that I have any personal choice in the matter, living with my son as I do, I also think that the answer to this challenge will come not from any ultimate solution to the intellectual problem, but from the ways in which we orient our own mainstream religious institutions. And I believe that the incredibly respectful ways we seem to conduct interfaith dialogue and worship and service together can hold the key. For when we demonstrate through our words and actions that our God teaches us to respect God's image in other human beings, including, maybe especially, those who don't worship or believe as we do, we teach a great and foundational human message. And it is a holy one that can lead to the renewal of belief and meaning in our own society. To play us in this morning, here's a song for peace, Hine Ba Shalom, Here Comes Peace, by Nurit Hirsh and Ehud Manor, sung by American cantor David Lipp.
Hine Ba Shalom Hu Yatsa Ledarko Shilshom Hu Karov Hu Karev Kol Yom Hine Ba Shalom הנה בא השלום. הוא יצא לדרכו שלשום, הוא קרוב, הוא קרב כל יום. הנה בא השלום, קריאתו כבר מתגלגלת ממזרח למערב. הנה הוא דופק בדלת, הוא לא יוותר עכשיו. הוא אלוף הקסמים, הוא חולף בסמים, לקולו חלומות קמים ונושמים ונושמים. קריאתו כבר מתגלגלת ממזרח למערב. הנה הוא דופק בדלת, הוא לא יוותר עכשיו. הוא עולה מן הים, הוא יורד מפסגת ההר, הוא ניסה והרוח שר, אין אפשר, אין אפשר. יצא לדרכו שלשום, הוא קרוב, הוא קרב כולם. הנה בא השלום.
That was Hine Ba Shalom, Here Comes Peace. When we come back on Two Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guest, Rabbi Richard Agler, and hear his moving, incredible story about transforming great personal loss into good and holy actions in the name of his late daughter, Talia. Hear all about it when we come back on Two Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style, it looks absolutely great, and it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish a close friend, Rabbi Richard Agler. Rabbi Agler suffered a great tragedy in his life when his daughter Talia was killed tragically in a car accident, and he has found a way to turn that loss into something meaningful in a variety of ways. Rich, good morning. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Sam. Thank you very much. We're honored to be with you today.
You're retired from Congregation B'nai Israel in Florida, looking forward to a long and happy life. And the great tragedy, Talia was 26 years old. She was killed while she was jogging. How do you deal with such tragedy?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that there's really nothing that prepares you for this. You know, even though as a congregational rabbi, I was called upon in many instances to help families, you know, through such a loss. When it happens to you, or if heaven forbid it happens to you, you really are not prepared for it. There are some maybe general parameters that you kind of understand, well, I need to get to this place, but it's a journey that you really have to make on your own, and each person's individual journey is different. Having friends around, having a faith system, and in Tally's case especially, you know, having someone who left a legacy, and I know we'll talk about that, but she had a meaningful, purposeful life and a life of accomplishment. And that helped us tremendously. So all of those things really contributed to our healing process, which, needless to say, is still ongoing.
You know, I think that you never, you know, recover per se. It never goes back to the starting point after a loss like this. It's easier for me to say that because, as you said, counseling other people isn't the same thing as experiencing it. You know, some 26-year-olds haven't really figured out anything yet. That wasn't so true for Talia.
It really wasn't. And, you know, she did know a great deal. And, you know, more than knowing a great deal, she directed her energies in various ways to making the world a better place. And even at that young age, you know, she did have success in those ways. Again, she left a legacy which really inspires, you know, a great number of people who have heard about her and learned about her or only knew her partially or didn't really know her full story. And, you know, that's a tribute to her, of course, and something of a comfort and a blessing for us as well.
We'll talk when we come back on Too Jewish about both some of the transplant recipients and an amazing story from Africa associated with Tali when we come back with Rabbi Rich Agler on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. Or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelber, to the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
There's a great group called the Tzofim, the Scouts, that Americans don't exactly understand what the Israeli Tzofim are. Maybe you can explain it to everybody.
Yeah, we have an amazing, energetic, young Israeli group of the Israel Scouts, the Friendship Caravan, that are arriving to Tucson. They will do two performances in Tucson. On the 16th, they will perform at Temple Emmanuel.
Great place, I might add.
And on the 17th, they will perform at the JCC. They are very energetic. They bring Israel to life on the stage. It's amazing. And they're a group representing the Israeli Scouts. Now, a significant difference between the Scouts here and the Scouts in Israel.
Like the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts here, right?
Right. There are two major differences. One is that in Israel, the Scouts are a youth movement, meaning that it is led by youth, managed by youth. Very few adults that are mainly staff persons are in the Scouts. It's not like here where you have all ages and you have people growing up in the Scouts. So that's one major difference. You know, all the guides, all the teachers or whatever you call them. I don't remember how you call them here, the troop
troop leaders and
are all teenagers. At the age of 16, you lead a group of sixth graders, seventh graders. At the age of 17, you would lead the eighth graders, ninth graders, and so on.
Wow.
So that's how it works.
It's really a movement of the youth, not youth run by adults.
Exactly. It is run by youth. The youth are sitting on all the boards, all the meetings. They're making the decisions. They are planning all the activities, everything. And they're instructing the activities. The other major difference is that there is no boys versus girls scouts. It's one movement, boys and girls together, which of course make it a little more attractive, especially when people are teenage and they want to go to places where they can meet girls or boys, right? And in that specific performance of the Friendship Caravan, we'll have boys and girls, and they're singing, they're dancing, they're so energetic. It's unbelievable. Really, it's a show that must not be missed. It's amazing. Coming in the summer, bringing all this cool into the air, you should come and see it on the 16th at Temple Emmanuel and on the 17th on the JCC. If I were you, I would come to both shows, see them twice. It's so much fun. Bring the kids, bring your grandma, bring your neighbor, bring everyone.
Great energy, and I have to say, it makes you think that all Israeli kids are that talented, which I cannot possibly believe.
I will keep the faith on that.
Thanks, Guy. Great to hear about the Tzofim, the Scouts, the 16th and the 17th.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Turkey, which we've talked about pretty often here on Too Jewish, is going through something. Let's talk about it.
Right. Well, interestingly, I was just there, and it seemed perfectly normal. And everybody in Turkey is very friendly and hospitable, even Turks by adoption. So one of the people I met was a Taiwanese-American guy who's doing graduate work in Istanbul. And he's the first one who tipped me off to what has made major news coverage in the past few days. And that is what he described as a revolution in Turkey. Now, this revolution began quietly as a protest against a government plan to cut down some sycamore trees in a park in the very center of Istanbul, in order to develop what some of the critics described as a shopping mall and others described as a historic replica of an Ottoman barracks. But either way, there were going to be fewer trees and more buildings. And a number of protesters gathered, and the police really overreacted. It wasn't the military. It's not even clear that it was the central government. It might have been municipal authorities, whatever. But they used clubs and tear gas, and there were some injuries. And so the number of demonstrators quickly swelled, and the subject of the demonstration also expanded enormously to include, and you would guess, and probably many of our listeners would guess, that one of the subjects of protest was the current government's rapprochement with Israel and its easy forgiveness of the sinking of a Turkish ship, whatever, all that stuff. Nothing to do with Israel, nothing to do with Jews. In fact, on the contrary, many of the protesters are against what they see as the current government's betrayal of the Kemalist tradition of secularism. They see the government as being too Islamist. There was recently a measure banning the consumption of alcohol in public, so you can't like drink beer at a soccer match, which particularly in urban Turkey and Western Turkey is considered really an attack on basic human rights and freedom of expression. In Istanbul, at least, if not nationwide, the current government banned the sale of alcohol after 6 p.m., again, seen as a strike for fundamentalists versus secularism and a betrayal of what modern Turkey stands for. But more broadly than that, even is, and this is what caused the protests to spread all over Turkey to like dozens of cities, a belief that the current Prime Minister Erdogan, who we describe using shorthand, which is neither entirely accurate nor entirely fair, we describe as being a fundamentalist. They describe him as being dictatorial and not democratic in his methods, not consultative, heavy-handed, high-handed, ignoring procedures, replacing personnel he doesn't like in senior military positions, et cetera, et cetera. So as this protest has spread, Erdogan actually left the country, and his deputy prime minister apologized for an overreaction and excessive use of violence. And I see that we're running out of time, so let's continue talking about this next week.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating because Erdogan has taken a great deal of power, and there's with grave concern, I think, in the West, particularly in Israel, that it was Turkey was becoming Islamist. Now there's a reaction the other way. Let's continue this next week. Thanks,
I look
Tom.
Forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mort sits at a table at his local deli and orders a pastrami sandwich on rye. 5 minutes later, his waiter arrives with the sandwich, but Mort can't believe it. His waiter is holding the sandwich down on the plate with his thumb. "Look," says Mort, "I'm not meshuggah. You don't think I'm going to accept that sandwich with your thumb all over it?" And the waiter says, "Well, I'm sure you don't want it to fall on the floor again." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in the book of Numbers, we read the odd ritualistic portion of Chukat, the rites of the red heifer. In order to achieve true ritual purity, ancient Jews were required to find a completely unblemished young red female cow, slaughter it, burn it to ash, and mix the ashes with water to create a water of purification in which to wash away ritual impurity. While many elements in the sacrificial code of our ancestors seem odd or alien, this might be the strangest of all the rituals. For it turns out that the red heifer, the Parah Aduma, makes the one who is washed in its ash water pure, but makes everyone else who comes into contact with it impure. The mystery of this is rather complete. Commentators have struggled with its meaning ever since the time the Torah was given. Just what is it that makes the red heifer the right animal to bring purity to the people? And why does it make you pure if you use it properly, but make you impure when you are preparing it? The classic answer to the first question is that God ordains the use of a red heifer as a symbolic reversal of the episode of the golden calf. If the people sinned by praying to an idol of a calf, then the very real slaughter and burning of an actual cow and the use of its ashes might well atone for that transgression. But why should the process of making something that cleanses us ritually make us unclean? Perhaps the answer is also symbolic. The process of bringing holiness into our world is never an easy one. Working in the field of holiness is not simple. When you toil in the vineyards of the Lord, there's a tendency for the muck that always exists in the world to attach itself to you. When we seek to bring purity to the lives of others, we stand a good chance of exchanging some of our own innate sanctity for a bit of the grime that stubbornly persists in most people's existence. The complex reversal of holiness in a sacred cow like the red heifer symbolizes the way in which we can only bring sanctity and purity at a certain price. When we acknowledge that price, accept it, and learn to cleanse ourselves ritually afterwards, we replenish our ability to help and heal others. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Richard Agler, will teach us how to survive and grow from personal tragedy, and how to make the loss of a child into holiness. Hear his amazing story when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg, the last World War II veteran in the Senate and one of 13 Jewish senators, died last week and was eulogized at his funeral at Park Avenue Synagogue in Manhattan. Lautenberg's pallbearers included 17 U.S. senators. At 89 years old, he was the oldest senator at the time of his death, the last of the 115 World War II veterans to serve in the Senate. After a successful business career that made him wealthy, Lautenberg was first elected to the Senate in 82. He served three terms, then retired, but almost instantly regretted the decision. In 2002, he ran for the same seat and was reelected. During his time in the Senate, Frank Lautenberg was known for his crusades against alcohol and tobacco industries, pushing laws that raised the drinking age to 21 and banned smoking on flights in the United States. Thank you, Frank. Lautenberg also prided himself on his reputation as a fighter, and he was a successful champion of many liberal causes. May his memory be a blessing. In Israel, Better Place, founded in 2007 by the exuberantly confident entrepreneur Shai Agassi, was trumpeted as the king of Israeli startups, a company that would keep the air clean and the streets quiet while saving money for everyone. 6 years and more than $850 million in venture capital later, the dream is broken. May 26th, Better Place declared bankruptcy. Its management transferred to a liquidator. The future of its 38 battery switching stations in Israel thrown into peril. Thousands of vehicles built specifically for the company's network sit unsold on car lots, their future also uncertain. We stand by the original vision as formulated by Shai Agassi of creating a green alternative that would lessen our dependence on highly polluting transportation technologies, said a statement from the company's board of directors. The technical challenges we overcame successfully, but the other obstacles we could not overcome despite the massive effort and resources deployed to that end. The downward spiral began last year. Better Place lost more than $450 million in 2012. Agassi was ousted as CEO in October. The company had two more chief executives before falling under control of a liquidator. Israel was the company's principal market, its system seemingly well-suited to a country where drivers stay within a densely populated central region, and the price of gas is astronomical. Investors liked Agassi's vision, gave him the $850 million in funding. Even before the Israeli venture launched, Agassi had started a second network in Denmark and was planning others in Australia, the Netherlands, China, Japan, the U.S., San Francisco, and Hawaii here. Agassi was the face of the company, a relentless booster, named to several lists of the world's most influential people. But what is arguably the highest profile flop in Israel's history, a country legendary for successful startups, is actually no big surprise. Former employees, customers, and industry experts paint a picture of a company that grew too big, too fast, built a car too expensive and impractical for its market, and a management team with a penchant for burning through cash. I don't think Better Place failed due to a mistake in technology, said Sam Solomon, a venture capitalist, chairman of Mobideo Technologies, which sold charge station software to Better Place. It ran too fast with too much. They did not get enough of a critical mass in a single market to demonstrate success. Agassi had predicted that by 2010 there'd be 100,000 Better Place cars on the road. Actually, there were zero that year. The first charging stations did open in 2008, but the cars manufactured by the company Renault, the French company, but sold by Better Place, weren't actually available for purchase until 2012. And instead of building a compact car for traveling short distances, Better Place offered a family sedan. It sold fewer than 1,000 cars in Israel, and when sales hadn't picked up by the end of 2012, the board cut spending and released Agassi. Better Place's 38 switching stations may close in Israel this month. Some customers say they'll still happily drive their cars, which provide a cleaner, quieter, and smoother ride without the stations they'll have to charge them at home. Despite the setback, many still see a bright future for the electric car industry. Better Place was probably ahead of its time. It failed commercially, but it succeeded in getting battery-powered rubber to meet the road, as it were. In other news, changing its tune, Russia will not sell the S-300 advanced air defense system to Syria, said Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov last week. His statement came in reaction to the publication of an article earlier reporting that Israel had informed the U.S. of an imminent deal to sell the advanced ground-to-air missiles. Possession of S-300 missiles would significantly boost Syria's ability to stave off intervention in its civil war. Lavrov said Russia would fulfill the contracts it already has concluded with Damascus, but they do not include the S-300 system. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is expected to travel to Russia this week to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and discuss concerns over planned weapons sales. Back on May 9th, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. does not want Russia to sell weapons to Syria. It has opposed transfers of missile systems to the country in the past because of the threat to Israel. The government of Syrian President Bashar Assad has been seeking to purchase these S-300 missile batteries, which can intercept manned aircraft and guided missiles from Moscow, for many years. Western nations have repeatedly urged Russia to block the sale, which they say will complicate any international intervention in Syria's escalating civil war. And after a change in government, Bulgaria is backtracking on its assertion that a deadly terror attack in Burgas on a bus full of Israeli tourists was carried out by Hezbollah. It has withdrawn its support for the European Union declaring Hezbollah to be a terrorist organization. It's important that the EU decision be based not only on the bombing in Burgas, because I think the evidence we have is not explicit, said new Bulgarian Foreign Minister Christian Vigenin. Vigenin and her Socialist Party-led government took office last week. In the wake of the bombing last July, Israel, the U.S., and several other countries called on the European Union to designate Hezbollah as a terrorist group. Five Israelis and their Bulgarian driver were killed in the attack at the airport. Earlier last week, a British request to label Hezbollah a terror group was opposed at the European Union, with several governments voicing concern the move would increase instability in the Middle East. The reluctant countries included Finland, Austria, and Ireland. France is also against labeling Hezbollah in an effort to remain on good terms with Lebanon, where Hezbollah is a member of government. The UK has classified Hezbollah's military wing as terrorist. The countries that clearly identify Hezbollah as a terrorist organization are the US, Israel, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Finally, our News of the Weird department reports that a JCPenney tea kettle resembling Adolf Hitler sold out online. JCPenney, which has come under fire for advertising and selling the space-saving tea kettle, sold out the item on its website quickly. The retailer's site said the Bells and Whistles stainless steel tea kettle, designed by American architect Michael Graves, is back-ordered until June 26. Don't go buy one. Following Memorial Day weekend, JCPenney also removed a 10-foot-high billboard near Culver City, California, which advertised the tea kettle. The kettle and its resemblance to Hitler have caught the attention of commuters. Photos and criticisms of the kettle spread rapidly on social media sites like Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. JCPenney insists that any resemblance to Hitler is purely coincidental. If we had designed it to look like something, we would have gone with a snowman or something fun, the company tweeted. A product review from May 28th titled Mein Tea Kettle lists as a con that the appliance looks like Hitler. And it's weird, but that's part of the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Richard Agler. He's a good friend. for many years in the interest of full disclosure, and not only a wonderful guy, but also someone who's had to cope with tremendous loss. He and his wife, Mindy, lost their daughter, Tali, in a car accident at the age of 26. She was jogging. How, in addition to finding the capacity to sort of get past the initial shock, you had to make a decision about organ donation. Talk a little bit about that process.
Well, it really was a pretty easy decision to make. When we arrived at the hospital, and you know, we were summoned to Washington from Florida, you know, late night telephone call. We got on the first flight the next morning, and you know, arrived at our hospital bed 9:30, 10 a.m. She was essentially. It was essentially over by that time. She was being kept alive on a ventilator. And one of the questions the medical staff asked us was, you know, do you wish to have her organs donated? And, you know, of course, on top of all the other shock that was taking place, you know, that was certainly a shocking question as well. But we immediately said yes for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's what we believe in. And number two, it's what Tali believed in. She had designated it on her driver's license that she was wanted to be an organ donor. And, you know, we really simply affirmed and confirmed her decision. You know, understanding in the abstract that it had a great possibility to save life. When, as that, you know, that process of donating organs took place and really continues, I know you want to talk about this, we've had really a personal experience getting to know and getting to see in a tangible way, in a real life kind of way, as opposed to an abstract kind of way, how wonderful organ donation can be.
Tell us, you had the opportunity to meet the recipient?
Of Talia's heart.
Talia's heart, right.
That was just really a few months ago, about 14, 15 months after her passing. She was able to donate five sets of organs, her heart, one lung, pancreas, both kidneys, and her liver. You know, each of these, you know, went to, you know, we trust, we're sure, a deserving recipient, someone who really, you know, would not have lived, you know, without that, without those transplants. We, you know, have a saying in our faith, as you know, if you save one life, it's as if you've saved an entire world. And again, you know, these kinds of things existed for us, as I imagine they exist for most people, in the abstract, in the classroom, on the pulpit, and, you know, and what have you. We did, as you mentioned, have the opportunity to meet a couple of months ago Talia's heart recipient, and it was overwhelming. A television station in Washington flew her and her husband down to Florida to meet with us. They wanted to film it, and we agreed to do that in order to, you know, encourage people to promote the idea of organ donation. And, you know, when they came, seeing this woman alive, along with her husband, you know, really literally weeping tears of gratitude to us, you know, it was an overwhelming kind of an experience. And we're, you know, and, you know, moreover, as if that wasn't enough, my wife Mindy got to put her head to the heart recipient's chest. Her name was Martha, and listened to Talia's heart beating. I mean, what can you say? Our daughter lives, continues to give life, save life. We remain extremely grateful, you know, for that. And again, I guess the reason we underwent such an emotional, you know, experience was to be able to promote to people or announce to people or make it clear to people what a great, great, as we say in Hebrew, mitzvah this is, what a great opportunity that each of us really has, or most, many of us have, to save people from the brink of death and give them literally a new hold on life.
Amazing story. You know, for those of us who signed up for an organ donation or went and did a registry, you know, it all seems very academic. Yeah, of course you should do that. But to hear
exactly, and you know, it becomes very, very real, you know, after undergoing something like this. as you might imagine, down in Florida and also in Washington, we have connections with the transplant clearinghouses and so on. And these are wonderful people who speak in the community at hospitals, community events, churches, synagogues, you know, anywhere where you, motor vehicle bureaus, anywhere where you might name, to encourage people, to make people aware of, you know, how powerful, you know, an act this is. We recently attended a luncheon of gratitude to the donor families that was sponsored by the University of Miami Life Alliance, I believe they call themselves, which, you know, and we were at a, you know, a setting in a beautiful place in Miami of, you know, literally hundreds of families who had had someone be an organ donor in that family, or hundreds of people, you know, many, many families. And also there were recipient families there as well. So, you know, from the tragedy that all of us, you know, experienced and endured, we see new families whose life has been saved. And I want to go back to that, you know, well-known statement from our Talmud: if you've saved one life, you've saved an entire world.
That's right.
Well, not only does that say that each individual life is worth, you know, an entire world, but each person, we realize, is the center of their own world. You know, now that person is not just a life. That person is a parent, a spouse, a child, a brother, a sister. They've got coworkers. They've got friends. There's a social network. You know, none of us live by themselves. So we save all those worlds as well when we, you know, when we donate an organ. So it's, again, an extremely powerful act.
Extraordinary story, too. Tell us about the Talia Agler Girls Shelter in Nairobi.
Yeah. When Tali was an undergraduate at American University in Washington, D.C., you know, like many students, she chose to take a semester abroad. And make a long story short, she ended up in Nairobi.
Instead of going to Paris or London.
She ended up there. She was counseled, you know, because of her interests, that this would be a good place for her. And sure enough, you know, she found, connected with an institution there, a very modest one, called the Center for Domestic Training and Development. And I'd like to tell you about that if we have a moment to begin with. It's founded by a woman named Edith Morogo. And the purpose of it basically was to train domestic workers, you know, people who work in other people's houses. Typically, they are extremely poor and uneducated, and they serve in people's homes in the third world, as in many other places on the planet. There's an enormous disparity between rich and poor. And people who were hiring would often abuse, you know, their employees, whether out of ignorance or whether out of, you know, power, exploitation, or however you want to call it. They were, you know, they would mistreat their domestic workers any conceivable way you can think of. And so this woman, Edith, who's a middle-class woman, said, you know, this is not the way it has to be. It was a situation that was really terrible pretty much all around. And she said, you know, what if I would train these workers and teach them how to use a vacuum cleaner so that the boss doesn't have to yell at you stupid so-and-so, you know, plug in the vacuum cleaner when they come from a house which has no electricity and so on. So to make a long story short, the people were able to, you know, train themselves. And this increased their own market value. You know, they understood that they, you know, that they would be a more valued employee. And even more wonderful than that, in order to hire any of her graduates, the employers had to take at least a little bit of a mini course, understanding this is how you can, this is an appropriate request, this is an inappropriate request. You have to give them a day off a week, and so on and so forth. And so Tally worked and taught in the Center for Domestic Training and Development. And she loved it. She understood she was making a difference in people's lives, giving people, you know, life skills and sense of self-worth and dignity. And, you know, it was, Mindy and I would say that Tally and Edith were a match literally made in heaven. So when Tally, you know, went back, she had a wonderful experience there and, you know, felt really a great sense of accomplishment. When she went to work after graduation, she found a job that in a company called Chemonics in Washington that basically it receives U.S. government money, and they assist with development projects in the third world. And Tally, by virtue of her experience in Kenya, got herself assigned to the East Africa desk, and she was able to return there and help out and in other ways and be supportive to the center. After she passed away, Edith came to the United States. It was her first trip here, and she was invited to address a couple of women's conferences that were taking place in Washington. And Edith said she wanted to meet with us, and she flew down to Florida in one afternoon from D.C. to visit with us. And, you know, we simply expected that we were going to share some stories and comfort one another and so forth. But in addition to that, she told us that she discussed with her board that the center had established a center or a shelter for young girls as young as age 8 and 10 through their teens and even early 20s who had been victimized by trafficking. And, you know, you can imagine the horrors that go with that.
Of course.
And they said that they were going to name the shelter after Talia in her memory. I get emotional telling you the story even now.
Yeah.
So it's the Talia Agler Girls Shelter in Nairobi. And actually, Mindy and I and our other children are planning on visiting there next month. And we're looking, of course, forward to being there and seeing her legacy continue.
Can people make donations to support the girls' shelter?
They absolutely can. I guess the easiest way to do that is there's a couple of ways to do that. You can look on my website, which is rabbiagler.net, RABBIAGLER.net. There's a Talia page there, and you scroll down, and there's a button you can click. The donations can also be accessed through Global Giving, which is a wonderful organization that certifies charities around the world as being worthwhile. If you go to Global Giving, you'll type in Talia Agler Girls Shelter or something similar in Nairobi. It will come up. There'll be a video there, and people can absolutely make donations. It's again, we come back to, if you've saved one life, you've saved an entire world.
I want to come back to a question that plagues everybody experiencing really tragic loss. What does it do to your faith? Here you were a rabbi serving for so many years in a congregation, promoting faith, in effect. What does it do to your faith?
Well, it's absolutely been a challenge. I guess the easiest way to answer the question is to say that my faith has been sharpened, by this experience. Having counseled other people through it, having studied it, from the academic perspective, is one thing. But when you actually, undergo it, it's quite something else. You know, there's a statement you've heard, I'm sure, all politics is local.
Yeah.
Well, all theology is personal. And when, you undergo something of this magnitude in your personal life, it seems that it absolutely has to affect your relationship with God, your theology, your thoughts, your experiences, and so forth. So I say mine has been sharpened, and actually one of the ways that I've been coming to terms with it has been through writing. I've got many, many thousands of words in my computer on the subject, and I'm looking to start editing them and so on. But I want to share with you and your audience something that I said at her memorial services. There were two, one in D.C. and one in Florida, is that, our faith is what it was that enabled us to raise a daughter like Tally and two other wonderful children as well. And, it was the teachings of our faith that helped make her who she was. And to turn away from that is the last thing that we're going to do, that we would ever think about doing. Again, there's this new perspectives, there's deeper perspectives, there's sharper perspectives. But I know sometimes people say, after this tragedy or after this horror, how can you have faith in God and how can you believe in God? I acknowledge that it's difficult and challenging and different, but to walk away is the last thing that we would do.
I want to thank Rabbi Richard Agler for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And your website is rabbiagler.net.
I think if you type in .com, it'll still come up.
It'll still come up.
RabbiHagler.net.
We'll find you. Rich, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Sam. Thank you for the opportunity. Best wishes to you and all of your audience.
And to you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Cantor Hillel Tigay, exploring contemporary Jewish music and his new CD, Judeo. Our playout this morning comes from that CD. It's called Pitchuli, Open for Us, the Gates of Righteousness. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.